This is Paul Adamson, and I'm in conversation with Pierre Vimont. Pierre Vimont is a former French permanent representative to the European Union, a former ambassador of France to the United States, and was the first executive secretary general of the European External Action Service. He has also served as chief of staff to three former French foreign ministers. As we've established your credentials now, Pierre, so let's get stuck in. In the course of this podcast, if we have time, I'd like to touch on four broad areas. The impact of the newly elected French President, Mr. Macron, on the future of Europe, the revival or the perceived revival of the Franco-German axis, the reaction of the rest of the European Union to that revival of that axis, and if we have time at the end, because I can't resist it, some views of yours, some wisdom on Brexit, on the rest of the European Union. So let's start, first of all, in your view, we have clearly a very pro-European French president. He's clearly elected on a very strong pro-European mandate. His party, La République En Marche, dominates the Assemblée Nationale. So your first views in these early days of his presidency of the impact of President Macron on the rest of the European Union, please.
I think there are two reasons for Macron's impact on European affairs. First of all, is that he put European affairs right in the center of his election campaign. Nobody had ever dared do that. European affairs usually are a main source of division among political parties in France, so they hesitate very much in talking about European affairs. He dared do so, and he was victorious at the end of the day. The second reason, I think, why it had such an impact, and this is interesting about what we usually call the European democratic deficit, right, is that it seems to me that more and more we're witnessing now in Europe a new political landscape which is encompassing all member states together. In other words, it's not only the French election that was followed very closely by the other ones. It was certainly the last year the Brexit referendum, but also this year the Austrian elections, presidential election, recently Netherlands, elections in Netherlands, and soon to be the German election. And now it seems to me that national election, domestic politics, are having a huge impact on the other electorates and what's going on all over Europe. And it's striking to see how the French election has impacted everyone all around Europe. You know, this idea France is back again, ready to move ahead, is something rather new that I hadn't seen before. So yes, it's having an impact. Yet, let's be honest, everything still needs to be done. We're only at the beginning.
But is the quid pro quo what you're saying, that's interest in member states at national election level, that the populism is on the retreat then? Could we safely say that populism has now been dealt a fatal blow, or is it still there lurking in the background?
I think it has suffered some blows, but the reasons why we've seen this upsurge of populist movement are still there. You know, the French electorate is still very much divided, and I think Macron is the first one to admit it. You still have a very profoundly divided France, with half of the citizens, the well-off, very happy with globalization, ready to go ahead with European affairs, a cosmopolitan part of the country, young people who are well educated, who go on Erasmus program. And then you have the second half, totally left out of this economic growth, feeling somewhat out of tune with the rest of the country. These people are not very well educated, they live out of the cities, in the countryside, and they feel somewhat abandoned. And you have to take that into account. If President Macron and his government are not able to make this half of France understand that now they're going to be taken care of and they're going to be helped, and we're going to have new policies that will solve their problems, they will vote again for the populist movement in the future.
Well, I think in some of his public statements since becoming president, he has alluded to his sensitivity, his awareness of these issues you're talking about.
Absolutely.
In France. But in practical terms, how do you measure, how do you identify the pro-Europeanness of Macron? I ask the question slightly provocatively, because one of the things he has said also is that obviously Europe is part of the solution, not part of the problem. But he's also talking for rather classic things like a new European definition of, dare I say it, protectionism, no? European work for European contracts, that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. His pro-European stance needs to be detailed, because it's not at all this sort of what de Gaulle used to say, it's not enough to jump on your seat talking about Europe, Europe right. like a ship, a cabri, as he used to say. it's about, and this is what Macron is saying, we shouldn't be talking time and again about whether we should stay in Europe or leave the euro or whatsoever. We're here to stay, we are part of Europe, and we have to stay inside. But Europe needs to be reformed deeply, profoundly, and I'm here to do it. And I think there sometimes here in Brussels, in this Brussels bubble, a bit of misunderstanding about Macron is talking about. Macron is going to be a true reformist. He's going to want, he will want the institutions to change, to be more matter of fact, to be more in tune with what public opinion thinks in our different member states. From that point of view, it seems to me that he has a little bit of the same narrative that at some time Matteo Renzi was having and saying, okay. let's forget about discussing all those detailed regulation nobody's understands or interested in. Let's talk about what Europe can really bring to the average citizen in terms of protection, in terms of delivering the kind of globalization that will be now under control. Macron is very much aware of the reaction recently with regard to the EU-Canada trade agreement, the CETA right. agreement, and the way reactions were very strong in here in Belgium, but also in other countries. He's very much aware of the very cool reaction to all the negotiations around the TTIP, the trade agreement with America. So he's not a man who's going to lightly accept everything the Commission puts on the table. He's going to watch this very carefully.
Okay, but with respect to him and the issue of reform has always been bandied about in the European Union context, even this Brussels bubble that you talked about. I mean, and to be fair, Juncker, who became president of the Commission almost 3 years ago, right, talked about being more focused, having doing less, but doing it better, all that kind of mantra, which is itself not a new thing. So do you have confidence that this time round, because it's coming out of the mouth of Emmanuel Macron, that the reform debate will have more political weight behind it?
Yes, I think it will, because never forget, we may come back to that later on, since Juncker was elected and since he was appointed the head of the Commission, and he has done some really good work in terms of downgrading and downstreaming many of those
peripheral activities,
etc. He has still been facing some major challenges, the two main ones being the Brexit vote last year and then the Trump election with an American leader who seems to be thinking totally differently from what his predecessor were thinking in terms of trade, in terms of security and defense, so on and so forth. So even Juncker himself has been talking, and then you had the Bratislava agenda set up by the European Council last year. Juncker is pushing forward ideas about the future of Europe and the new ideas we need to be thinking of and what kind of future Europe we want to have. And all this, in my opinion, fits rather well with Macron's agenda. Macron himself has been talking about launching a national consultation in France about the future of Europe and what Europe should be, the bottom-up approach, where at last we ask the citizens what they want to see
in
as the future of Europe.
I'll interrupt you on that one, without being too cynical, is that quite a sincere exercise in your opinion, or slightly a public relations exercise?
No, I think it is sincere. I don't know how to do it, and let's be honest.
Yeah.
Our democracy are not used to this kind of bottom-up approach, and they don't know how to deal with that. But in times of social networks, of people giving their opinion every hour on the networks, I think there is something to take out of this new trend and to try to put it into this democratic debate we need to have about the future of Europe. Because Europe will not survive if it's not able to adapt to this new reality.
Okay.
This is really necessary nowadays.
Okay, well, let's move on to the Franco-German engine, as I think we call it, the moteur. I mean, do you think it's going to be plain sailing? I mean, whether it's Mrs. Merkel or Mr. Schulz re-elected in Germany in September, do you share the kind of enthusiasm, even the euphoria, that the Franco-German engine seems to be about to be reactivated, relaunched?
I think the reasons behind this euphoria, to some extent I would say this over-optimism following over-pessimism in recent months, I think we need to keep the balance straight. But I think what is true is that France has been absent for the last 5 years in this debate with Germany because of its economic problems, because it was not able to play a real part. There was no more new ideas coming out of Paris, and there was someone missing there. There was an absence. The fact that Macron, with Macron, France is back, has a lot of ideas and wants to push forward, I think can only come as a good fortune for Germany. Now, of course, then it's all about putting the two countries together and matching their ideas together. We tend to forget that the French-German engine, the French-German partnership, has never been an easy thing. You know, we all talk now, and we have reminded this a few days ago with Helmut Kohl's death, that all seems sunny and going well with Mitterrand. But the beginning of their relationship, which was a very difficult one, and even at the time of the German reunification, Mitterrand was very cool about this and somewhat
suspicious
and asking for more. And this is how they built together the whole Maastricht Treaty, which was a good thing in the end. Yeah. But it was a very long, hardsome task to do this. So I don't think for one second that this French-German new boost is going to be an easy piece. There will be difficulties in every field.
Could you give me one or two examples where you think there will be these kind of difficulties? It's not going to be a walk in the park, as you say, but what are the potential pitfalls of preventing this axis getting off the ground?
Everybody's talking about security and defence and the need to launch, let's put it that way, a new European defence industry, new programmes in terms of capacities. We've been through that for nearly 15 or 20 years, and every time cooperation between Germany and France on the whole issue of military equipment has been very difficult. Our industries do not match together. Surprisingly, France has less difficulty with Britain to launch industrial programs. And you remember at some point when we had this idea of merging French Airbus and British BA, it was the Germans who were asked to come in and who refused at the time.
So
you have to be aware that this is not going to be difficult, and yet it is very important. It is a priority. So we will have to overcome these hurdles as we move along. The Eurozone.
Yes, I'd like to ask you about Eurozone governance.
We don't share exactly the same ideas about the kind of economic cooperation we should be looking for, how to to neutralize financial resources in order to help build more investment. The French have also a lot of idea about more institution in the Eurozone, European Finance Minister, European Eurozone Parliament. The Germans are not against that, but they don't see it as the most important priority for the time being. So we have differences, but that's what it's all about. The French and the Germans have this great ability, once they manage to agree, to bring together many other member states. And this is what is important about the German-French engine.
Well, you said just now that the France had been absent, your word, not mine, for 5 years because of its economic problems and other things, no doubt. And these issues about Eurozone governance were canvassed then, of course, during the previous presidency of France. So why do you, about the issues about institutional arrangements you're referring to, for example. So why do you think there's grounds for optimism this time around in under the new situation that there'll be some kind of agreement on Eurozone governance between France and Germany that hasn't happened before?
I think, first of all, because the French, when I'm saying that France is back, it means also that the Macron government must be ready to do the necessary French reforms that have been missing recently in terms of the labour market, in terms of regaining control of our public finances. All this, the government in France has said it was going to do it. It's even accelerating its timetable. So it's going to be very interesting to watch during the summer what are the first decisions that are being taken by the French government. If that happens, it will bring back confidence and trust in Berlin, and this is really what it's all about. And the timeline is perfect. You know, the French do the necessary first reforms they have to do during the summer. Then you have the German election. Whoever is elected then is ready to work with the French together in order to transform slowly Europe. I think that works rather well.
In the timing, the sequencing.
Yeah, the sequencing. But to start on all this, it's for the French, first of all, to show that they are sincere in their willingness to reform the country.
Domestic reforms.
Yeah. Okay.
When I did one of these podcasts recently, Pierre, with Carl Bildt, I raised the issue, obviously, the newly launched or about to be relaunched Franco-German engine. And he said, I know it's a good thing, he said, but it should not be allowed to dominate. How do you react to that kind of statement?
I think he's absolutely right. And this has always been the point about the German-French engine, is that all our partners think it is indispensable. And if we don't have that engine, nothing really works in Europe. But at the same time, they always recognize and underline the fact that you can't have it alone. It's not for the German and the French to decide for all the others. And don't forget that now we're 28, maybe 27 when Britain will be out, but we're 28. And you just can't act as if the 26 others do not count and are irrelevant. So it's a whole matter of working well together, but keeping in touch with all the others and convincing them to be on board and to work together. And there you may have some strong opposition from some of the member states. So this will need to be taken into account and to be overcome. So it's not going to be an easy piece of cake.
Because you said at the beginning of this conversation that you were talking about the positive impact of the Macron election, maybe directly, indirectly, on national politics in other member states. But one can see also, and you know much better than I do, there's a certain fragmentation with inside the European Union. It is far from being a bloc solidaire, as you know. And so how concerned are you about this perceived fragmentation of the European Union?
I am concerned for a reason that I think is not stated enough nowadays, is that with the enlargement, which, by the way, I think was a very good thing, the latest enlargement, the fact that we have taken on board all the Eastern and Central European countries and help them to make this extraordinary economic success of their economic reform, we have brought inside the European Union member states which have a different memory from the others about the history of the European construction and the purpose of the European construction. In other words, the original members started in 57, 58, as we all know, with a clear idea about what they wanted to do. They had differences, but their idea of the European Union was a very much political one, and they have stick to that to that purpose, and it's still there for them, even if it's more complicated, and even if we have moved from pure federalism to something which is very different. But there was still this idea that European integration should go ahead, should become more closer, so on and so forth. I'm not so sure that the new members have exactly, first of all, they don't have the memory, and they have a different history about Europe. They come from a totally different places, the Soviet Union and the Soviet camp in the 70s and 80s. And their perspective about European integration is maybe less ambitious than the other ones. If you take Poland, if you take Hungary today, and maybe others, they're much more attached to this idea of improving the single market, performing better in economic terms. I'm not so sure they're looking for more sharing sovereignty, for more security and defense. They think NATO is much more well suited for that. And therefore, you have to bring together two different mindsets, two different narratives, which is much more difficult than only, you know, to sit around the table and strike a deal on post workers. It's more than that.
So does it suggest, therefore, there has to be a trade-off, that the bigger the European Union becomes, the more member states it allows in, the weaker or the lower level of ambition of integration as a corollary? Is that a...
Yes, and that's why you come in with this whole concept of flexible Europe, which to some extent makes some of the member states uncomfortable because in their opinion it's the beginning of what will appear to be in the end a sort of two-tier or two-speed Europe, which they don't like. But the reality is that with these two different narratives about our ambitions for the future of Europe, it becomes a real political problem, because for those who would like to move forward and have an ambitious concept of integration, and those who are reluctant to move at least too quickly or maybe even to move at all into one of those ambitious goals, who is the one who should give up? None will want to give up. So it's about accommodating those different narratives and finding a way of, for those who want to move faster, to be able to do it, and faster and deeper, and those who, for the time being at least, cannot go along, to be allowed to stay in, of course, and to have a different status.
Right. Mm-hmm. So in the remaining time available to us, yeah, let's move on and finally to Brexit. From your point of view, how big a deal is it, this possible imminent departure of the United Kingdom from the European Union?
Well, we still have a lot of work to do there. It seems to me that what we're facing today is a bit of a different situation than the one we were facing before the last June elections. And it's not only about
the June elections
of this year, right?
Right.
The 8th of June British elections.
Right.
And the fact that Mrs. Theresa May has found herself with no majority anymore in the House of Commons, and the need to find the support of the Unionists. This, to some extent, has reopened the whole Pandora box about what kind of Brexit do we want, where are we heading for the hard Brexit against the soft Brexit. And this is a very fascinating debate, because people never try to define really what they're talking about.
Yes, beyond hard and soft.
In my opinion, I still think we're moving ahead towards a Brexit, which means at the end of the day that Britain will be out of the European Union. And then the real question is still going to be, now for the time ahead, what kind of arrangements will Britain try to define with the rest of the 27 member states who will remain inside the European Union? Will they go for a partnership? Well, they will try to keep as much as possible of the current arrangements of the single market. Will they go for something different, for keeping as many arrangements as possible inside the customs unions? I think the problem we're facing when we're looking at the British government is that we have the impression that they haven't really made up their mind.
Mm.
They have set up some red lines. No freedom of movement, no intervention from the European Court of Justice. But once you have said that, you still have a very large spectrum of options possible. Do you go for keeping many of the provisions of the single market or the customs union, or do you go for a free trade agreement? What kind of provisions do you want to have? And this is going to take a lot of time, because every time you look at one of the current arrangements, you find out that once Britain is out, it's going to be very difficult to renegotiate, and what kind of
replace it with something else,
what kind of new arrangement we're going to have. So the main question is that one. Once you have decided that Britain definitely is going out, what kind of partnership Britain will want to have with the European Union? Mrs. Theresa May alluded to that in her Lancaster House discourse. She wanted a partnership that could be as close as possible for the benefit of all. This is all very well, everybody agrees on that, but then it becomes a matter of details. And looking at the details, one finds out that it's going to be a very long process of negotiating these details, which means maybe at some point they need to have a sort of transition period necessary for the negotiation of these arrangements.
Right. There's a narrative out there, as you know, quite well established in certain elements of the commentariat, whether national, European, even international, that the United Kingdom never really joined the European Union. In effect, it's always been a reluctant partner, a difficult partner to deal with. Do you go along with that? And is Brexit a kind of logical outcome of our half-hearted membership, the UK's half-hearted membership of the European Union over the past 40-odd years?
Well, if you look at fact, this is really what we have been witnessing for the last 14, 15 or more years. The whole thing starting with the Maastricht Treaty, where Britain asked for some opting out of the Eurozone, out of social Europe, out of many of the home affairs sector, even if on opting in they can choose to pick up which one of these provisions they like and they want to stick to. The reality is that we had a Europe that was in with a lot of opting outs, and now we seem to be looking at a Britain that will be out, but who will be asking for a few opting ins.
Yes.
Maybe at the end of the day it wouldn't be all that different, except for one thing, which I think a public audience in Britain hasn't well understood, is that if we have some sort of special individual partnership between the EU27 and Britain, one thing will remain for sure is that Britain will be out. In other words, the decisions that the 27 will take will be without Britain.
So that will have no influence on policy making or decisions. One final question, Pierre, and finish off. So you seem quite resigned to the fact that the United Kingdom will leave the European Union within 2 years. So what will the European Union look like without the UK at the table?
I think it will be a major loss. And I don't say that because I'm speaking to a British citizen, but really because I think so. Every time I speak with my former British colleagues, now that I am retired, I'm always impressed by their intellectual quality and how the kind of contribution they bring to any kind of debate, be it on foreign policy, on security and defence, on economics, on agriculture, on free trade, whatever. And I think the simple fact that we won't have those British colleagues at the table, as I was saying before, will be a big loss. Of course, I would prefer much more to have Britain staying in, but that depends very much on the British voters. Mm-hmm. And for the time being, I see no change there. Maybe it will happen before the end of the two-year negotiation of the Article 50. We will see. Mm-hmm. But for the time being, I think we have to take it for granted that Britain is leaving and that we have to negotiate the best possible deal for both sides.
Okay, one final comment from me anyway. I remember your new president, Mr. Macron, did say when asked a question at a recent press conference, we leave the door open until it is finally shut. So let's, on that more positive note, let's finish this podcast. Pierre Vimont, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.